And so it goes back to there's really no unhealthy emotions. They were built into us with a purpose. Feeling sad and angry and anxious is telling us something is very wrong. And emotions remain healthy when they flow. So it means acknowledging it, taking a little time with that, and then it probably won't keep you up at night in the same way and may likely give you more energy for the work.
Hey, I'm Michael Yadrick, the host of Tree Hugger Podcast, and I am broadcasting from the land of the Puyallup people, also known as Grit City, Tacoma, Washington. This is the show where we reimagine ecological restoration and the episode where we discuss our feelings of anxiety with climate change. My guest on this show is Dr. Leslie Davenport, who works as a climate psychology educator and consultant. She integrates social science insights into relevant resources for organizations exploring the intersectionality of climate, economics, policy, and social justice. I want to give credit where it's due. I first heard Dr. Davenport on the Climate One podcast in 2020. As you might know, climate-oriented podcasts are one of the genres I consume. Good things come from reading the show notes. I came to learn that Dr. Davenport lived in Tacoma, and I'm so glad I finally invited her on the show because while some people are better at expressing their emotions than others, few people have the vocabulary to talk through how climate impacts them and the things they love. Dr. Davenport is one of a handful of psychologists and educators I came to learn about focusing on climate. In fact, there's a whole network of them, and I will drop some links in the episode's details so one can find resources to read, watch, listen, or someone to talk to if you need them. I think almost all of us do, whether you know it or not. I am very grateful that Dr. Davenport lives here in Grit City, aka Tacoma. A while back, she was gracious enough to come over to Tree Hugger Studios, also known as my living room, to drink some tea and record in person. She has a fascinating resume. Dr. Davenport helped shape the document Mental Health in Our Changing Climate, Impacts, Implications, and Guidance. She is the author of four books, such as Emotional Resiliency in the Era of Climate Change, which provides theory, strategy, and resources for mental health practitioners addressing clinical themes specific to the psychological impact of climate change. Dr. Davenport is also an advisor for the nonprofits Climate Mental Health Network, Integrative Healers Action Network, and One Resilient Earth. She is on faculty with the California Institute of Integral Studies Master's Program in Professional Psychology and Health. What spurred me finally to reach out to Dr. Davenport was that I saw she published a book in September 2021 called All the Feelings Under the Sun. We spent some time in this episode unpacking this book that helps young readers work through their feelings about climate change. I read much of this book with my tween son, and it provides age-appropriate information about science, feelings such as grief, tools geared around resiliency, and inspiration to make change. Importantly, I like the book because it addresses not only our Western science conception of the changing climate, but also highlights traditional indigenous knowledge and highlights youth activists. And guess what? Although I love me some Greta Thunberg, not all these young heroes are white or European. The book also digs into the overlap between climate disruption and systemic racism. Like everything else, climate impacts and our feelings about it are racialized. So why did I produce this episode for Tree Hugger Podcast? The more I think about it, it is a long time in the making. This might be too much information, but stick with me for a bit because I would like to do my part to destigmatize mental health challenges and normalize storytelling about it. You may have noticed by what I've said or the vibe I put out that I had a deep bout of depression and anxiety a while back that preceded the creation of the podcast in late 2019. Depending on how far I look back, my mental health challenges were partially related to big life changes like my family move to Tacoma, the 2016 election results and aftermath, and a few injuries that kept me from my main physical activity and passion of running. Running was also my pressure valve for mental clarity and community. I couldn't literally run away on a long forested trail anymore. Finding balance takes time. I wasn't sleeping enough, which led to over-caffeinating and then compensating by drinking too much at night and turning the knob up on an already existing habit of overwork. Even though I think I love my, and you may love your occupation that might help save the world, honestly, work doesn't love you back unless you have some boundaries. My panic attacks showed up when I was in large groups and small meetings alike. Pains in my chest, shoulder, neck, tingling down my arms, and brain fog. My eco-anxiety was and is tied up in all of this. I did some talk therapy for months, and Vivian told me it seemed like I had experienced trauma of some kind, but we couldn't pinpoint any real-world event, and I do not remember vocalizing or even having the vocabulary for my persistent worry and rumination about the future of Earth and future generations that live upon it. About this time, I was trying to figure out climate change, its impact on forests, my community, and how ecological restoration could be the solution. I couldn't accept the trope that we were fucked and there wasn't anything we could do about it. I doubled down on learning about vulnerability, species sensitivity and exposure to climate, and adaptive capacity in our ecosystems. I sometimes still dabble in this semi-intense thing I call podcast research on my bus commute. I download a bunch of focused episodes based on keyword searches in my podcast app. Sometimes I have a queue of episodes just waiting with what I think are the answers to the existential questions I seek. Hence gravitating towards content about this unique nexus of climate and mental health. While it brings you things like interesting podcast content, I wouldn't recommend it and encourage balance because it can be real extra and overwhelming sometimes. Nevertheless, producing Triager Podcasts and the last few episodes particularly have helped me feel my feelings more fully, and I've given myself permission, and I'm giving you permission, to identify, acknowledge, and sit with the highs and lows of living in a warming world. For a few years now, I have been pulling out of that hole of fatigue by changing habits and adapting and trying a whole bunch of scary new things. I will spare you because I feel like I'm already oversharing right now. The basics are like allowing myself to sleep, consuming plant medicine prescribed by a naturopath I trust more than anyone, us pulling back on commitments I thought I was obligated to do, forest bathing, learning about my vagus nerve and nervous system, just breathing normal and in funny ways, plunging in cold water, cultivating my gut microbiome, and a healthy contempt for capitalism, though questionable how productive that is so far. And overall, while uncomfortable, I accept any and all my feelings and others' opinions as real and valid. This has helped me start recognizing abundance in our ecosystem where I once saw threats. I endeavor to be more vulnerable and embrace my right to be cold in a warming world. I expect some of you listening may have similar feelings and challenges. You might have found this Triager episode because of the same search for answers. Some of you may be managing your emotions as actual victims or frontline ecosystem defenders dealing with the real-world effects of environmental racism and climate change in your community. I am not entirely equipped to tell you exactly how to cope or deal with your emotions, but I do have the power to reach out and use whatever privilege and power I have to help find perspective from people like Dr. Davenport. Just know you are not alone, and we need to be on each other's side. Together, we will get relaxed and intentional with our feelings about climate change while we resist and adapt and navigate our way. I'm glad to bring you this episode about our feelings about climate. It starts right here. Enjoy the conversation.
My name's Leslie Davenport. I live in Tacoma, Washington, and I'm working as a climate psychology educator and consultant. And I know that that title probably requires a little unpacking. It's not something that most people are familiar with. My training and credentialing is as a marriage and family therapist, and I've been licensed for probably about 30 years. I began to focus it toward our climate crisis somewhere between 10 and 15 years ago. And what happened for me was I've just always had a lifelong interest in the environment and ecology. And there wasn't a single pivotal event, but there was this cumulative impact of reading about what's happening that just opened my eyes to the severity of what we're facing in a way that I could never turn away again. And at that point, I decided to do everything possible to shift my personal and professional efforts toward addressing climate change. And when it comes to the work I'm doing now, This was before terms like eco-anxiety were even in our conversations. But I began to realize, okay, so we're saying climate change is caused by human behavior. Human behavior. Who studies human behavior? Oh, I do. And I started to see how many of the things we're trained in, like how to process grief, how to move through denial, how to facilitate conversations so they're not contentious, how to work with big, deep emotions, how to motivate change, how to communicate, suddenly became so relevant. It seemed obvious to me, but it was before those dots were really fully connected. So while I do see people in a private practice setting, I am taking what I've learned and making it available in a variety of ways. There are more and more environmental and advocacy nonprofit groups who are starting to realize the emotional impact is debilitating and influential, and have started to request staff training to bring some of these tools in. There's also been some work with nonprofits about what's the best way to language campaigns so that it promotes engagement rather than pushing people away or overwhelming them. And then with my recent book for teens and tweens, there's been some interest in bringing a more emotional, intelligent approach into the climate curriculum that's being developed for schools.
There's a climate curriculum. That is a big surprise to me. That's super cool.
Well, yeah, early stages. But okay. Yeah, there's now interest in we need to have this be part of science.
Yeah.
I just recently spoke at an annual conference for science teachers in California and was able to talk about how important it is that we pair resiliency tools as the information is being presented.
Are you okay to tell me about your Tacoma story?
Sure.
Yeah. Have you always lived here? Have you recently settled here? I feel very blessed. I mean, I feel like you're my neighbor. We didn't know each other until just now, but I feel proud somehow that like this esteemed climate psychologist and counselor lives like so close to me.
Well, yes. Now, I've been here next month. It'll only be 4 years. And so my orientation to living in a new place has also been influenced by COVID restrictions. I haven't been able to venture out quite in the ways I had originally imagined. But prior to coming here, I had lived all the rest of my life in California. And my adult life and my career and raising my family was in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it was a combination of things that brought me here. One was being pushed out financially from the rising costs of California life. But the bigger one was actually a draw, which is to be very hands-on in helping to raise my grandchildren, who are currently 3 and 5, and live about a mile and a half away.
Nice. Okay. That was a good draw. It's like a magnet, sir. But it seems like you have a little tether still to like San Francisco.
I do.
A little bit.
Okay. I have a huge professional network and other family and friends. So yes, still a fair amount of my work comes out of California. I'm licensed to practice there as well as Washington. Okay. So thanks to our technology, I can do quite a bit virtually.
For sure. Yeah. I spent some time there a while back too. It's a cool place to go. I have your book here in front of me. And so Miles and I did read, well, I read all of it. Miles made it halfway. Not to say he didn't like it, but his comments were, it's like very interesting. Like he's very much into, he loves the science part of it or whatever. But I did figure out, like, I don't think he's worried so much.
Okay.
So I took it as a good sign. Maybe we'll dig into that a little bit more, like, because some people just, it doesn't bother them, you know? So
yes.
Yeah. So the book, you know, it's focused on youth, like teens and tweens.
Yes.
And the content skips between information about climate, like really good, succinct climate science, and then honoring these lived experiences of the youth activists, which I loved. And then introduces these resiliency exercises that you talked about. I'm not exactly sure what that means. And I don't know if the listeners do either. So I'd like to unpack that a little bit. How did this approach evolve when you were creating the book?
Yes, happy to talk about that. There's actually a method to the madness of going back and forth. And from trauma studies, trauma research, it's called toggling. And it's very intentional that we read or the book presents information that can be triggering because there's, you know, as you said, it's pretty straightforward, even though it's age appropriate. There's things about extinction and climate refugees and you name it. It's in there somewhere, rising seas. And at least for some people, and we can talk a bit later about how widespread things like climate distress are. It really triggers worry. For some kids and adults, it goes more toward depression, acting out. We can talk about the range of ways people respond. But the idea is that the material is presented, and then there's a way to be with, address, and process in a healthy way the feelings that it could trigger and tends to trigger. Because the basic approach is that if people are upset, angry, frustrated, sad, that means that you're paying attention and you care. In fact, it's a really normal human response, and it would be sort of unexpected if there wasn't at least some of that some of the time. So what I found is that, kind of broadly speaking, people either tend to be activists, let's do what we can do in whatever way, and kind of say it's a bit of a waste of time to deal with these feelings, or go the other way. You know, I'm going to do yoga and meditate and just feel calm, but not necessarily engage and be involved. And what I'm trying to do is bring both of those together, that it really needs to be accessing the full range of what it means to be human, which is going to include times of upset, along with finding ways that we can each do our part, because this is at such a level of existential crisis that I believe every human field and discipline needs to reevaluate in terms of sustainability practices. You were talking about your own son not necessarily feeling the emotional part, but there's a big study that was released 2 months ago, and it focused on a slightly older age group. It was 16 to 25-year-olds. 10,000 youth interviewed, close to half felt some distress related to climate on a daily basis in a way that felt that it impacted their functioning. More than half were adopting this perspective that we're doomed, it's too late. And I think it was about 46% that just believe that the things they value most are going to be destroyed. And those are just a few of the summaries. I mean, it is big, and that's why if we can catch the kids earlier on, who are even going to likely be moving into a more challenging world, and equip them with these essential life tools, you know, all the better. So anyway, you could link a study like that that just says why it's so important, even if they're not feeling it at this point.
Okay. Yeah, we'll slip it in the show notes.
No.
If Lucky was any producer at all, she'd be Googling it, be able to Google this right now for us. Yeah, I'm down to read. I will follow up on reading recommendations. Good stuff. So the resiliency exercises, because I feel like a lot of folks, even teens and tweens, perhaps, that are activist bent, like some of this information is in the news or whatever, but maybe the resiliency exercises they're not really used to. So some of these things. So I was wondering if you could discuss like your favorite one or some of the exercises. I have my favorites. I feel like I'll tell you. I don't know if you're interested in hearing.
No, I'd love to.
But like the one where we talk about our feelings as like a weather report.
Yes.
Right? That one was super cool because I was just thinking about, we have all these, obviously we live in the Pacific Northwest and we have a lot of rain. So we have all these words for rain as maybe like a negative thing sometimes. But then also we just recently experienced some very extreme weather, like a bomb cyclone. So I was like, how often do you think of your emotions like, however I ever felt like a bomb cyclone, right?
Yep.
You know, it's like, so the bomb cyclone, for everyone who's not familiar, I don't think this is a real term or just made up in the news, but it's essentially like this like very like a tornado, like a lot of rain that we got and wind and everything. But then the other one, which I had heard of only actually in the biohacking community.
Okay.
Seriously, like optimizing your human health and brain function and everything. This, the one where you shake.
Oh, yeah.
Seriously, I never expected that to be in here. But the shaking one where animals who are being hunted as prey, perhaps, will escape. And then, in, like, you'll see the National Geographic or the David Attenborough videos.
Yes.
Like, they'll escape and they're safe. And then all of a sudden, they'll just, like, shake like crazy. That's what they think is to just shake off that trauma,
yes.
I guess, right? That they almost or they did experience.
Yes, it resets our nervous system.
And then there's so many good ones, but the butterfly fluttering one on the collarbone is great. And then the grounding, which is like, I feel like sort of foundational for everyone. So anyway, so sorry if I ruined it.
I don't know if you had
any other good ones. Okay.
So I think I want to say a little bit more about how I'm defining emotional resiliency. And then the exercises will make a little more sense in that context. So one of the things in the book you might remember is a concept called our window of tolerance or zone of resilience. And this also comes out of trauma research. And the idea is that we function within this range of emotional mental stimulation that has a ceiling and a floor on it. And if there's too much stress or too intense of stress and we go sort of above our optimal ceiling, or drop down below, we see that as either moving into reactivity, knee-jerk reaction, lashing out, anger, or the bottom is more like shutting down, numbing out, I've had enough, I'm withdrawing, I can't talk. And this is a really basic human experience. You know, if you think about being in a heated conversation with somebody, and you realize you can't really access your best self. And a common thing to do is just step away, have a cooling down period, come back and see if you can talk it through in a better way. And that's essentially what I'm talking about. And in the case of the book, it's in the context of if and when we start to feel overwhelmed with these climate-triggered emotions, so that the practices are to help us become more aware of where our personal edges are, how to expand our window of tolerance, when to consciously step away and take a break rather than unconsciously just having to shut down. So the same outcome kind of happens, but we can do it in a more graceful and skilled way, an optimal way. So many of the practices, including the ones you were referencing, actually work with nervous system reset, like the shaking. The butterfly hug is this tapping one that works, again, not just with our thoughts and feelings, but with the way our body holds stress and tension. And one of the things I love about the internal weather report, because that one is, I believe, the very first exercise, is that it puts emotions and feelings in a very friendly context. You know, it's like, oh, okay, you know, well, like the weather, these feelings kind of come and go. And some days I feel kind of bright and sunny, and other times I'm hazy, and other times there might be an atmospheric river on the way. And so one of the overall goals of this book and my work at large is we have developed a society where we're kind of afraid of emotions and feelings, and it works against us, especially in the realm of climate change, because sometimes what looks like, for example, apathy, people that just are like, oh, well, business as usual, somebody will figure this out, is actually a type of shutting down response to feeling overwhelmed. If I think about climate change, if I read about what's happening, I'm upset, I can't sleep, I feel don't know what to do. I don't know how to buy groceries at the grocery store because I'm using all these fossil fuels in that process. And so I can't deal with this. Oh, well. And it's we don't recognize how big our emotions are driving a lot of this. It might appear to be something else. So it's bringing a much more nuanced and comprehensive understanding really of what it means to be human, and where our emotions and feelings fit into that, and then how to be skillful about it. I'm by no means promoting people should be walking around feeling upset, But if we allow ourselves to feel the natural feelings that get triggered, it actually allows them to pass and subside much more quickly than if we try and keep them at bay.
Right. And I think for myself, I find myself kind of going back and forth sometimes. Like sometimes I feel like I don't have room room in my brain. That's the way I think of it. There's just like, it's all full right now of other things. But sometimes I'm ready to like devour more information and learn more about the topic because I feel like I can fix things maybe, right? So, and thinking about this kind of shutting down, but we're on the back end after COP26, right? And so there's very high level, the most tippy top high level policy discussions in the world just occurred. And to a great extent, I'm not feeling the most optimistic about the outcomes that we can keep the world's temperature to like 1.5 degrees Celsius above baseline. And, you know, a lot of the youth activists were calling it greenwashing. And there was a whole gang of fossil fuel lawyers and advocates there. And so to a certain extent, you know, I want to be able to reassure other people, myself, that there's some hope for the future. Everything will be okay. But how useful do you think hope is when scientists may or may not be that confident that we can resist the current trajectory of environmental change and climate impacts on living things? How do you feel about, and because we've talked about hope in the podcast before, so I'm thinking, like, is hope an emotion we can rely on right now?
Really important question. And I just want to acknowledge I'm with you 100% with your summary of what's happening in COP and what came out of that. There's a quote I really like. I don't know who to attribute it to. Maybe a lot of people say it. But rather than trying to find hope to spur us to action, that hope can follow action. That if we find a way to, without knowing where it will bring us, how much benefit will come of it, but it's aligned with our values, what we see as most important, with a role we can play, that is when we can feel perhaps more hopeful. I think when it comes to psychology, another part of what you're describing that's important to recognize is our brains, based on evolutionary psychology, are not very good at being in this ground of unknown about what's going to happen, especially when there's high threats and high risk. And there's unconscious impulse to land. And we often land on everything's going to be all right, or we land on it's way too late. We're doomed. You know, what's the point? And without saying what's realistic, because I'm not sure we know that other than we are in change and there are going to be impacts that are already baked into where we are, I do believe, and I'll, you know, align with people like Catherine Hayhoe in the field who will say this too, that there's still a lot of room for what may come and what timing may happen. And I don't think she said it, but I heard someone talk about, rather than this idea, this metaphor that we're kind of driving off a cliff with climate change, it's more like there are different exits we can take, and depending which ones we take will be lesser or greater impacts. And so to keep it alive, to keep it dynamic, to keep it unfolding, to see what our part may be in this more flow-like dynamic than believing that it's landed already, I think is just more accurate to the situation we're in.
Yeah. God bless Catherine Hayhoe. I hope she's like resilient because she takes a beating and she seems to be willing to duke it out in the Twitter sphere.
Yes.
She's so good. Maybe I should put a link to them in the notes because I think she coined the term global weirding, right? So it's not climate change. Because I often avoid using that term climate change too, because it's like things are weird.
Yeah.
Climate is being disrupted. It's sort of a thing that's not just changing. But that word change, I think, is important too, because I do have a favorite author right now, Adrienne Marie Brown.
Oh, yeah.
She's very much an Octavia Butler disciple, and talking about getting in right relationship with change. And actually just finished a book of fiction called Grievers.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, actually, I just got rid of it. I would have given it to you. I just, after I read books, I usually just take them to the little library, just stick them in there. So, but Grievers, and talked about a parallel to kind of a COVID situation sometime in the future where there's a pandemic. And you don't know if it's like passed by people like breathing on each other or touching, like actually you don't know if you can't hug or shake hands, but it's really just caused by, like, they kind of zero in on grief, really. And I don't know if our culture, I don't want to stereotype, but some cultures are better at grief, right?
And completely agree.
Mine is not, probably. I don't think so, right? So, and I don't know if that's the opposite of hope, but it's kind of almost, I don't think it's, I almost think it's the opposite of hope, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, that's an interesting consideration to pair those. Again, you know, I tend to go with what I said a moment ago of we tend to put things in a fixed perspective when actually they move and flow. And so to the extent that grief, like so many things, is a process, and there are a lot of feelings connected to it and a span of time that it happens over, I do feel like if we can grieve and move through normal grief, it makes room for things like hope. Because again, it's dynamic and it opens things up. And so to that extent, I definitely see a relationship.
Good. Yeah, and I don't know. Yeah, I just feel like it's not really taught. No one taught me how to grieve. You just sort of like are thrown into it, I guess. I don't have the vocabulary for it right now.
Well, you know, one thing really important in what you're saying is any kind of loss triggers grief. Not, we tend to think of it as the loss of someone we care about that we love. But any kind of loss, so loss of a sense of future that a lot of youth talk about, loss of confidence in our governmental leadership is a kind of loss process, a grieving process, loss of an environment, a neighborhood that we grew up with because of changes is a kind of loss. And that's why I'm saying these things that are naturally triggered that we can expect to feel are tied into things like that.
That's right. So I've been talking, I'm actually parallel with this conversation we're having now. I've been working on a different episode, talking with some of my colleagues and coworkers about climate impacts to our local trees.
Yeah.
So we're seeing these different trees start to suffer, essentially, like start to die. Individual trees, sometimes whole patches or populations of trees.
Yeah.
Some species are more sensitive, or some forests are more exposed to climate. And so I asked a few of them, and this is like their career focus. This is what they do for work. And it's like, I've been asking them recently if they experience eco-anxiety due to what they're witnessing on the front lines of forest health in our region. They all said yes. However, kind of provided a mixed bag of responses. And when I dug a little deeper about how they might cope with it, the most common answer was like to do the work. Let's just dig deeper, right? And do their biology or organizing citizen science or adapting ecological restoration practices. And I know that's probably maybe somewhat healthy, but what else do you think would complement our ability to cope with this maybe not so unique type of stress that climate disruption presents?
Yes, this kind of circles back to some of the things we've been touching on, but I feel like there's so much we need to unlearn, these myths we're living by that are related to climate change and everything else. And the one related to emotions and talking about your friends and colleagues coping is again about feelings and emotions. And I think the thing we've got wrong is this idea that if I let myself feel sad, I will fall into this pit of despair and I will never crawl out. And boy, that's a waste of time. I don't have time for that. Or same thing, if I let myself feel the anger and frustration, perhaps governmental inaction or whatever might be triggering that, I will just, you know, rage out of control. And there's so much work to do and so little time. But again, what we've learned about emotions and feelings is that It's when we try and push them aside, push them down, ignore them, that they pop up and kind of come out sideways.
That's exactly what happens. It just comes out random place.
Yeah. And, you know, and think of it this way. Like, you've got this big ball and you're trying to hold it underwater.
Yeah.
Takes a lot of energy, a lot of focus, and your arm gets fatigued and eventually it pops up anyway. And that's kind of like our emotions. And so it goes back to, there's really no unhealthy emotions. They were built into us with a purpose. Feeling sad and angry and anxious is telling us something is very wrong. And emotions remain healthy when they flow. So it means acknowledging it, taking a little time with that. And then it probably won't keep you up at night in the same way and may likely give you more energy for the work. I'm really trying to take this out of an either or thing, but that how much they need to be hand in hand, that this is a lived human experience and we all need to do our part. Mm-hmm. And it's when we can, kind of going back to the book, toggle back and forth between these that we are going to be the most effective, the most powerful, have the most energy for it. Have the greater clarity of mind about what's possible.
That's right. Yeah, and I feel like talking about it outside of these technocratic solutions, because like as scientists or as ecologists, we're often trying to like tinker with the ecosystem, like manage it and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But really there's a, particularly with different rights holders and stakeholders and people who were trying to get involved in some proactive action for the environment or for our neighborhoods, we need to be able to tap into different vocabulary, I feel like, because we can't always present it like, you know, we're saving the environment, right? Mm-hmm. We're doing this for the environment. So I feel like we need to tap into that social side, because otherwise we're going to leave people behind. There's so much urgency behind the work that we'll just kind of steamroll these solutions that people don't feel comfortable with, and probably lead to some inequitable outcomes as well.
Very much so. You know, I think before we officially got started on our conversation, you were mentioning a little bit about we have siloed approaches, and this is a little bit what you're referring to now of, you know, tinkering or addressing things in the steamrolled way. And I understand the impulse, because there is this sense of urgency. But it takes me a little bit to a famous quote that's often attributed to Einstein about we can't solve problems by the same mindset that created them. So that deeper look, again, including our psychology along with other things of like, what is it about how we perceive ourselves and life and each other and our place in the environment that has also led to the problems? And to look at things without recognizing that interdependent, interconnected reality that ties into this siloed, let me just do this one little slice, is part of the problem. It's very common, but if we look at a tree, we're talking about trees, the only or primary way we see them is as a commodity without seeing, feeling all in one, their role in cleaning the air and the regulation of the temperature and all kinds of things that you probably know more about than I do. That, again, that is part of the problem. And so one of the things I hope to bring is actually this deeper shifting of the lenses in front of our eyes. You know, it's not fanciful, it's not poetic, it's biological, this interconnectedness that actually affects the air we're breathing right now. It's just very real, but again, this false myth that is culturally enforced. So it's just another layer of what I hope, as I study the brain and the nervous system and our evolution, what I can bring. And it's really about more dismantling some of these inaccurate perceptions.
So I did share with a few people the news that we're going to record this conversation. And I sent your website link to a friend, and they seem to be a fan. I don't know where they found on your website. They Googled you, but they're a fan of this piece you wrote a few years ago about ecological imagination.
Mm-hmm.
which maybe is what you're kind of starting to talk about, just being able to imagine change or imagine solutions that just aren't a band-aid, they're kind of addressing core problems. And so they called out this quote, "Engaging our imagination is far from fanciful. It's a critical part of finding the answers to these questions, an essential practical act that allows us to continue discovering and embodying the full spectrum of our humanity and our place in the family of all things. Can we imagine a world in which all beings can thrive? If not, no amount of policy discussions will get us where we want to go." So, yeah, is there anything more you'd like to explain about ecological imagination? Because it's, I kind of think I know what you're, what it is. For me, you can add any word on the back of ecological and I'll be like, yeah, that's my thing. I love it. That's my love language. So I guess, what are some ways we can curate this in our lives? Whatever it is, I'm willing to bite.
Yes. So another way to think about this, and it is related to what we've already been talking about, is the value of different ways of knowing. So again, our predominant Western society really values analytical thinking. And I'm all about it. I hope that part of my brain works for a very long time. But it's so far from being the full scope of human potential. So there's whole bodies of study about what we're saying of our emotional intelligence, our somatic or body-based intelligence, things that can happen which probably haven't really been named, about maybe even an environmentally oriented intelligence, how we feel and perceive when we're spending time outside, tuned in a different way. So this is about kind of creative intelligence, and I don't want to separate it from the way it fits together with the whole. And again, I like some of the Einstein stories, because you may know how he, I believe, it's been a while since I've read this, but I believe he was discovered relativity by first imagining himself riding on a beam of light. He went through this kind of visualization meditation, which then allowed him to put the pieces together in a scientific context. So again, it's like, how do we bring on board these parts of our human capacity that have become dormant because of how our society and culture has created this hierarchy of value? And that's really what this is about. So let's imagine a future that's not only driving on jammed freeways in green electric cars. You know, great, better air, better lot of things, but what else might be possible? Mm-hmm. And it's not a waste of time to think outside the box, because we create our boxes, you know? So that's kind of the essence of what that's about.
Excellent. Exploring, I guess, other ways of knowing, I think, is important. I think is that takeaway. We're stuck so much in this, the Western science side of things, that helps to explore what other people have to say about the trees or about how we're mobile around the cities, you know, like what sort of things we drive in or on or walk around. Some things I ask everyone is what your favorite tree is or one that you're fond of.
Yes, I'd be happy to answer that. Rather than picking in kind of a generic sense, I tend to get attached to trees that I know. So in the backyard of where I'm currently living is a grand fir. It's really impressive. I mostly know it by its trunk because it's so tall, but it's got this big, it would take at least two of me, I think, to wrap my arms around the trunk. And it is just so, I don't even know how to describe it, just so present and strong, and feels like it kind of just hums. And I just feel very grateful that it's so close to me.
That's a great one. We could talk for a while about grand fir. Oh my gosh. I cannot think of one that I am familiar with in town. So
that's great. I'll have to have you over.
I know. No, yeah. Because like, as from the windows, you know, we can see, I don't know if you can see behind me or over here, like there's Douglas firs all over the place. south part of town, there's like the transition into formerly this grand oak prairie, you know, that used to be there. Actually, I end up planting a lot of them. I put them in the plant pallets.
Oh.
Yeah. They're probably maybe have some issues with the warming world. However, so a lot of times they're pretty shade tolerant. Mm-hmm. So in like shady forests, they'll kind of just chill. Mm-hmm. In the shade for a long time until there's a little bit more light, and then they'll just like go blow up. I've had some anxiety about overplanting them because I come from this background that sort of honors historical fidelity in the environment.
Sure.
And I'm worried about, you know, trying to maintain what used to be in a place. And since it does so well in, I don't know if you care about any of this, since it does so well in the shade, and it can actually handle a little bit of well-drained soils, and they just, like I said, they hang out in the shade, and they take like 30 years to become sexually mature.
Because the branches are like above me, and so it's just kind of this presence of like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, every time I see it.
I love to see the cones on that. Do a lot of cones fall? Are a lot of cones falling all over the place? Yeah, it's a great tray. No one has said grand fir, but that's the one in your backyard. That's your
backyard.
Buddy in the backyard. Kudos. All right. I like that one. All right. How can people find out more information about you, your work, the book? Where can they find the books?
Okay.
Because multiple books. Sorry, we're just talking about one book, but you are an author of multiple books.
Probably the best way, I've tried to use my website, includes a calendar of talks and programs and teaching and things about my background and where to find the book. So it's LeslieDavenport.com. Pretty straightforward. Best way to find out about me, and there's ways to reach me that way too. And wherever books are sold, I, of course, love it when my books are kind of, they're pretty niche. You know, this one, Teens with Climate Focus and Tweens. So may not be at your local bookstore, but most, of course, can order it.
Okay. Is there a way, should I advocate, should I send a sternly worded email to my school principal about getting it in the schools?
Oh, it would be fantastic. You know, and the other thing I'd
maybe
say...
I always say sternly worded email, like an email that is like...
Enthusiastic.
Enthusiastic for it.
Well, because, you know, this is, I feel like one of our chances. I keep talking about these myths and how we need to shift them, but... to the extent we can bring it into the educational system, you know, with younger kids, then we've got this next generation growing with comfort and familiarity with a lot of what I've been describing. And the other secret about this book is that any adult who picks it up with some kid in mind but reads it would get an awful lot for themselves. It's it's basically the same concepts as I have written about in professional journals and things, but just in a very friendly, accessible language. But honestly, the practices and the key concepts are the same.
Yeah, it is great. I thought it was very accessible and reminded me of things that I should not have forgotten. And then there was new heroes, right? I never even knew about some of these kids that have done this work. Like a lot of people know Greta and some of the other activists that are up and, you know, speaking to the United Nations. But yeah, there's others, there's so many more.
Like Kid Brooklyn. I kind of like that one's fun. This 10-year-old who started a comic book series in New York about a superhero gang of friends who go around making things better in the world. And
Now talking about this out loud, it's good. We do have a librarian, our school librarian at Miles's school, Mrs. Bethel. I doubt she's listening to this, but they're in the middle of this like global reading challenge right now. So yeah, I got to figure out ways to slip this into the right hands. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for coming over.
It's been great. Really fun to talk with you about this. And I'm so glad you're including this.
Oh yeah. I hope it helps other folks that are not only into ecological restoration, but are just wondering what's going on and how they can tune in a little bit better to their emotional resilience.
Yeah.
This has been great.
Yes. Same here.
All right. Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Super.
And that's a wrap.
Thanks for joining me again for another episode of Tree Hugger Podcast. I'm Michael Yadrick. Please check the show description for information about Leslie Davenport. She can be reached through lesliedavenport.com and Twitter. The archive of this episode also lives online at treehuggerpod.com. Tree Hugger Podcast is on social media at Tree Hugger Pod, so feel free to point people in our direction. Subscribe, rate, and review the show, please, on whichever podcast platform you enjoy listening to. It helps people find the show. Or tell a friend about the show. The music for the show you heard from Cheel and DJ Freedom. One can find a link to them in the show description. Thanks for hanging out. See you in the woods.